of denying them this grand reunion. Maria threaded her way through the crowd, greeting people she'd never known existed. Handsome, dark-eyed seventh cousins kissed her hand and whispered compliments in a beautiful dialect she didn't understand. Veiled widows in elegant black dresses stood arm in arm with their resurrected husbands. Children weaved between the adults' legs, stealing food by the handful and cramming it into their mouths on the run. The clinic's neurologist turned out to be a distant relative. Maria cupped her hands to the woman's ear and shouted over the noise of the party.
"Have I been scanned yet? Will my copy remember any of this?"
The neurologist explained that the scan only captured memories laid down permanently as changes in synaptic strengths. The fleeting electrochemistry of this dream would be lost forever. She added cryptically,
"Lost to whoever's not having it."
Maria felt herself waking. Suddenly afraid that she might be the copy, she struggled to remain in the dream, as if she could force her way back through the crowd, back through the plot, and leave by a different exit. But the scene grew vague and unconvincing. She could feel the heavy presence of her waking body, her aching shoulders, her swollen tongue. She opened her eyes. She was alone in the Landau Clinic's cheerfully decorated recovery room. She'd been wheeled through for a patient's eye view before being given the anesthetic, so she'd know exactly what to expect. It took a few seconds for the truths of the dream to fade, though. Her father was dead. Her grandparents were dead. There'd been no grand reunion. There never would be. As for the copy, her scan file didn't even exist yet. The raw tomographic data would take hours to be processed into a high-resolution anatomical map, and she could still change her mind and keep the results out of Durham's hands altogether. He'd paid the clinic for the scan, but if she refused to hand over the file, there'd be nothing he could do about it. The recovery room was softly lit, lined with odorless blue and orange flowers. Maria closed her eyes. If Durham's logic meant anything, raw tomographic data could probably process itself, find itself conscious, as easily as any copy who'd been chopped up and run at random. There was no need for a finished scan file. No need even to be scanned. The very same data surely existed, scattered about the universe, whether or not it was ever plucked from her brain and assembled in what she thought of as one place. In fact, if Durham was right, if the events he believed would take place in his TVC universe could find themselves in the dust, then those events would happen regardless. It could make no difference what anyone did in this world. The whole Garden of Eden project was superfluous. Every permutation of the dust which was capable of perceiving itself, making sense of itself, would do just that. And all she would have achieved by refusing to be scanned would have been to deny the Maria of that permutation a history which seemed to overlap with her own particular life. While a third woman, in another world, another permutation, would have taken her place in that role. Maria opened her eyes. She'd just recalled the first thing she'd meant to do on waking. Every scanner was programmed to recognize, in real time, before all the arduous data processing that followed, the magnetic resonance spectrum of four or five special dyes which could be used for alignment and identification. The scanning technician had obligingly loaned her a No. 3 marker pen and instructed the scanner to blind itself to that particular dye. She pulled her hands out from under the sheets. Her left palm still read, "You are not the copy." She licked her fingers and started rubbing the unnecessary words away. Maria arrived at the North Sydney flat around 12:30. Two terminals were set up side by side on Durham's kitchen table. Other than that, the place was as bare as it had been the last time she'd called. Although it wasn't technically necessary, Maria had insisted that she and Durham be in the same physical location throughout what he called the launch, the running of the first moments of the TVC universe as software on a real computer. The act which would supposedly seed an independent, self-sustaining universe, taking up where the version relying on real-world hardware left off. At least this way she could monitor the keys he pressed and the words he spoke without having to wonder if she was being shown what was really going on at that level. She had no idea what she was guarding against, but Durham was a highly intelligent man with some very strange beliefs, and she had no reason to feel confident that he'd revealed the full extent of his delusions. His clients had confirmed part of his story, and they would have had the resources to check much more of it than she had, but Durham might still have lied to them about what was going on inside his head. She wanted to trust him. She wanted to believe that she'd finally reached the truth, but it was hard to put any limits on how wrong she might yet be. She felt she'd known him too long to seriously fear for her physical safety, but the possibility remained that everything she thought she'd understood about the man would turn out once again to have been utterly misconceived. If he came away from the kitchen sink brandishing a carving knife, calmly announcing his intention to sacrifice her to the spirit of the new moon, she'd have no right to feel betrayed or surprised. She couldn't expect to live off the proceeds of insanity and also take for granted the usual parameters of civilized behavior. The flesh and blood Durham was only half the problem. Once the program simulating a TBC cellular automaton was started, the plan was that neither she nor Durham would intervene at all. Any external tinkering would violate the automaton's rules, the fundamental laws of the new universe, making a mockery of the whole endeavor. Only Durham's copy, being run on the simulated TVC computers, could act in harmony with those laws. They would always have the option of aborting the project, pulling the plug, but in every other respect, the copy would be in control. Of course, aborting the simulation if something went wrong would not, in Durham's eyes, prevent the spawning of an independent universe beyond their control, but it might leave them with enough unspent computer time for a second attempt. With her hands tied once the universe was running, her only way to influence what did or didn't happen was through the Garden of Eden configuration, which included all the programs the TVC lattice would initially run. Maria had written part of this internal launch software herself. Durham had written or commissioned the rest, but she'd checked it all personally, and she'd built in a safeguard. All the copies but Durham's would be blocked from running until the TVC processors had solved a suitably intractable mathematical equation. Maria had estimated that the world's combined computing resources couldn't have cracked the problem in under a decade. $30 million worth, minus overheads, wouldn't come close. That was no obstacle in the eyes of Durham and his followers. The ever-growing resources of the burgeoning TVC universe would make light work of it, solving the equation within a week or two of the launch. But short of any such universe coming into existence, and so long as the test wasn't circumvented, there was no chance of a second Maria De Luca or anyone else waking. It was her guarantee that there'd be no virtual Jonestown, just one lone prophet flickering in and out of existence. Durham made instant coffee. Maria surveyed the Spartan room. She said, "This isn't good enough, you know. We should have 200 people wearing headsets and a giant screen taking up an entire wall, like one of the old NASA missions." Durham spoke over the sound of boiling water. "Don't worry. We'll be using more computing power per second than NASA used for the entire Apollo program." Computing power. One more thing to worry about. Maria logged on to the KIPS exchange. The rate was up slightly since she'd last checked, but so far there was no sign of what she dreaded. In the event that Operation Butterfly entered the market again, today of all days, the Garden of Eden would be frozen out, postponed until the Kips rate returned to normal levels. That wouldn't make the slightest difference to Durham or his followers, even if the launch program was thrown off the network halfway through and only completed days or weeks later. Real time was irrelevant. Maria could appreciate the logic of that, but the thought of a delay or an unexpected slowdown still made her sick with anxiety. Every legal opinion she'd obtained had made it clear that neither she nor Durham were likely to face prosecution, and if charges were brought against them, a conviction was highly improbable, and even if that happened, an appeal would almost certainly succeed. Nonetheless, every day she'd spent working with Durham as a knowing accomplice had made her feel more vulnerable to the whims of the authorities. Hayden had treated her icily when she'd confessed to having abandoned her laughable undercover role. The risk of harassment would hardly vanish the moment the project was completed, but the relief would still be considerable. She was beginning to regret having honored her promise not to try to record Durham's client's statements, assuring her that they were fully informed participants in the scheme. The authenticated messages she'd viewed on public terminals might not have been the equivalent of human testimony, but having them stored away on a chip somewhere would have made her feel a lot more secure. Regardless of the legal status of the copies, she couldn't imagine being prosecuted for fraud if she could show that the de facto victims of the crime knew exactly what they were paying for. Durham set her coffee down on the table. Maria mumbled thanks as he sat beside her. He said, "No last-minute qualms? You can still back out if you want to." She kept her eyes on the screen, the flickering pie chart of the Kips exchange.
"Don't tempt me."
As if she'd seriously consider blowing her one real chance to have Francesca scanned. After all the work, all the anxiety, for no better reason than a laughable microscopic fear that this artificial universe might actually blossom into self-contained existence. Durham's terminal beeped. Maria glanced at his screen. A message box said, "Priority communication." She looked away as he viewed the text. "Speaking of last-minute qualms, Ryman's changed his mind. He wants in." Maria said irritably,
"Well, tell him it's too late. Tell him he's missed the boat."
She wasn't serious. From what she knew of the project's finances, Durham had been set to barely break even by the end of the day. The price of one more ticket would transform his fortunes completely. He said, "Relax. It will take half an hour at most to fit him in, and his fee will cover much more than the increase in data. We'll be able to run the whole launch a bit longer." Maria had to pause to let that sink in. Then she said,
"You're going to blow most of 2 million euros on stretching out something that..."
Durham smiled. "That what? That would have worked anyway?"
"That you believe would have worked anyway."
"The longer I get to see my copy observing the TVC universe, the happier I'll be. I don't know what it will take to anchor the automaton rules, but if 10 watertight experiments sounds good, then 11 sounds better." Maria pushed her chair back and walked away from her terminal. Durham tapped at his keyboard, first invoking the programs which would recompute the Garden of Eden configuration to include the new passenger and his luggage, then directing the windfall from Ryman straight into the project's JSN account. She said,
"What's wrong with you? 2 million euros is more than $2 million. You could have lived on that for the rest of your life."
Durham kept typing, passing Ryman's documents through a series of legal checks.
"I'll get by." "Give it to charity, then."
Durham frowned but said patiently, "I gather that Thomas Ryman gives generously to famine relief and crop research every year. He chose to spend this money on a place in my sanctuary, It's hardly my role to channel his funds into whatever you or I decide is the worthiest cause. He glanced at her and added, mock solemnly, that's called fraud, Ms. DeLuca. You can go to prison for that. Maria was unmoved. You could have kept something for yourself, for this life, this world. I don't imagine any of your clients expected you to do all this for nothing. Durham finished at the terminal and turned to her. I don't expect you to understand. You treat the whole project as a joke, and that's fine. But you can hardly expect me to run it on that basis. Maria didn't even know what she was angry about anymore. The delayed launch? The obscene waste of money? Or just Durham sitting there making perfect sense to himself, as always? She said, the project is a joke. 300 million people are living in refugee camps, and you're offering sanctuary to 16 billionaires. What do they need protection from? There's never going to be an anti-copy revolution. There's never going to be shutdown. You know as well as I do, they'll just sit there getting richer for the next 10,000 years. Possibly. So you are a fraud then, aren't you? Even if your sanctuary really does come into existence. Even if you prove your precious theory right. What have your backers gained? You've sent their clones into solitary confinement, that's all. You might as well have put them in a black box at the bottom of a mine shaft. Durham said mildly, that's not quite true. You talk about copies surviving 10,000 years. What about 10 billion? 100 billion? She scowled.
Nothing's going to last that long, haven't you heard? They found enough dark matter to reverse the expansion of the universe in less than 40 billion years.
Exactly. This universe isn't going to last. Maria nodded sarcastically and tried to say something belittling, but the words stuck in her throat. Durham continued blithely, the TVC universe will never collapse. Never. 100 billion years, 100 trillion, it makes no difference. It will always be expanding. Maria said weakly,
entropy
is not a problem. Actually, expanding is the wrong word. The TVC universe grows like a crystal. It doesn't stretch like a balloon. Think about it. Stretching ordinary space increases entropy. Everything becomes more spread out, more disordered. Building more of a TVC cellular automaton jut gives you more room for data, more computing power, more order. Ordinary matter would eventually decay. But these computers aren't made out of matter. There's nothing in the cellular automaton's rules to prevent them from lasting forever. Maria wasn't sure what she'd imagined before. Durham's universe being made of the same dust as the real one, merely rearranged, suffering the same fate? She couldn't have given the question much thought, because that verdict was nonsensical. The rearrangement was in time as well as space. Durham's universe could take a point of space-time from just before the Big Crunch and follow it with another from 10 million years B.C. And even if there was only a limited amount of dust to work with, there was no reason why it couldn't be reused in different combinations again and again. The fate of the TVC automaton would only have to make internal sense, and the thing would have no reason ever to come to an end. She said,
so you promised these people immortality?
Of course.
Literal immortality? Outliving the universe?
Durham feigned innocence, but he was clearly savoring the shock he'd given her. That's what the word means. Not dying after a very long time. Just not dying. Period. Maria leaned back against the wall, arms folded, trying to cast aside the feeling that the whole conversation was as insubstantial as anything Durham had hallucinated in the Blacktown psychiatric ward. She thought, when Francesca's been scanned, I'm going to take a holiday, visit Aiden in Seoul if I have to, anything to get away from this city, this man. She said,
ideas like that are powerful things. One of these days you're going to hurt someone.
Durham looked wounded himself at that. He said, "All I've tried to do is be honest. I know. I lied to you at first, and I'm sorry. I had no right to do that. But what was I supposed to do with the truth? Keep it locked up in my head? Hide it from the world? Give no one else the chance to believe or disbelieve?" He fixed his eyes on her, calm and sane as ever. She looked away. He said, "When I first came out of the hospital, I wanted to publish everything, and I tried, but nobody reputable was interested, and publishing in the junk science journals would have been nothing but an admission that it was all bullshit. So what else could I do except look for private backers?" Maria said, "I understand. Forget it. You've done what you thought you had to do. I don't blame you for that." The cliches nearly made her gag, but all she could think about was shutting him up. She was sick of being reminded that the ideas which were nothing but a means to an end for her, the ideas she could turn her back on forever in 8 hours' time, were this man's entire life. He looked at her searchingly, as if genuinely seeking guidance. "If you'd believed everything I believe, would you have kept it all to yourself? Would you have lived out your life pretending to the world that you'd merely been insane?" Maria was saved from answering by a beep from Durham's terminal. The Garden of Eden configuration had been recomputed. Thomas Ryman's snapshot was now built into their cellular automaton, equivalent of the Big Bang. Durham swung his chair around to face the screen. He said cheerfully, "All aboard the Ship of Fools." Maria took her place beside him. She reached over and tentatively touched his shoulder. Without looking at her, he reached up and squeezed her hand gently, then removed it. Following a long cellular automaton tradition, the program which would bootstrap the TVC universe into existence was called Fiat. Durham hit a key, and a starburst icon appeared on both of their screens. He turned to Maria. "You do the honors." She was about to object, but then it didn't seem worth arguing. She'd done half the work, but this was Durham's creation, whoever cut the ribbon. She prodded the icon. It exploded like a cheap, flashy firework, leaving a pincushion of red and green trails glowing on the screen. "Very tacky." Durham grinned. "I thought you'd like it." The decorative flourish faded, and a shimmering blue-white cube appeared, a representation of the TVC universe. The Garden of Eden State had contained a billion ready-made processors, 1,000 along each edge of the cube, but that precise census was already out of date. Maria could just make out the individual machines like tiny crystals. Each speck comprised 60 million automaton cells, not counting the memory array, which stretched into the 3 extra dimensions hidden in this view. The data preloaded into most of the processors was measured in terabytes, scan files, libraries, databases, the seed for planet Lambert, and its sun, and its 3 barren sibling planets. Everything had been assembled, if not on one physical computer. The TVC automaton was probably spread over 15 or 20 processor clusters, at least as one logical whole, one pattern. Durham reduced the clock rate until the blue-white shimmer slowed to a stroboscopic flickering, then a steady alteration of distinct colors. The outermost processors were building copies of themselves. In this view, blue-coded for complete working processors, and white-coated for half-finished machines. Each layer of blue grew a layer of white, which abruptly turned blue, and so on. The skin of this universe came with instructions to build one more layer exactly like itself, including a copy of the same instructions, and then wait for further commands to be passed out from the hub. Durham zoomed in by a factor of 200, slowed down the clock rate further, and then changed the representation to show individual automaton cells as color-coded symbols. The processors were transformed from featureless blue or white boxes into elaborate multicolored three-dimensional mazes, rectilinear filigree, alive with sparks of light. In the throes of reproduction, each processor could be seen sprouting hundreds of pairs of fine red and green construction wires, which grew straight out into the surrounding empty space, until they all reached the same predetermined length, abruptly turned a tight 180 degrees, and then started growing back in the opposite direction. Glowing with elaborate moving striations, the wires zigzag back and forth between the surface of the mother computer and an unmarked boundary plane until between them they'd filled in the region completely, like some strange electronic silk weaving itself into a solid cocoon. In close-up, the wires resolved into long lines of cells marked with arrowheads, some rendered in the brighter hues which represented activated states. Glowing stripes built from the binary code of bright and dim moved down the wire from arrow to arrow, the data of the blueprint for the daughter machine being shuffled out from the central memory. With the clock rate slowed still further, the process could be followed in detail. Wherever a pulse of brightness reached the end of a construction wire, the transparent vacuum of the null state was transformed into an embryonic cell, shown as a nondescript gray cube. Subsequent data told the new cell what to become, each pulse or absence of a pulse converting it into a slightly more specialized transition state, zeroing in on the particular final state required. The construction wires grew out from the mother computer using this principle, extending themselves by building more of themselves at their tips. Having filled the entire region which the daughter machine would occupy, then they worked backwards, retracting one step at a time, unweaving their zigzag cocoon, and leaving behind whatever the blueprint required. The whole process looked grotesquely inefficient. Far more time was spent on extending and retracting the wires themselves than on creating the cells of the daughter machine, but it kept the rules of the automaton as simple as possible. Durham said, "This all looks fine to me. Okay to proceed?" "Sure." Maria had grown mesmerized. She'd forgotten her urgency, forgotten herself. "Crank it up." At any speed where they could keep track of events at the level of individual processors, let alone individual cells, nothing useful would ever get done. Durham let the clock rate revert to the maximum they could afford, and the grid became a blur. In contrast, the next stage would be painfully slow. Durham made coffee and sandwiches. All the overheads of running a copy on a system of computers which was, itself, a simulation, added up to a slowdown of about 250. More than 4 real-time minutes to a subjective second. There was no question of two-way communication. The TVC universe was hermetic. No data which hadn't been present from the outset could affect it in any way. But they could still spy on what was happening. Every hour, they could witness another 14 seconds of what the copy of Durham had done. Maria spot-checked at other levels, starting with the software running directly on the TVC grid. The machine language of the TVC computers was about as arcane and ridiculous as that of any hypothetical Turing machine, six-dimensional or not, but it had been simple enough to instruct a metaprogrammer to write and rigorously validate a program which allowed them to simulate conventional modern computers. So the processor clusters in Tokyo or Dallas or Seoul were simulating a cellular automaton containing a lattice of bizarre immaterial computers, which in turn were simulating the logic, if not the physics, of the processor clusters themselves. From there on up, everything happened in exactly the same way as it did on a real machine, only much more slowly. Maria munched cheese and lettuce between thick slices of white bread. It was a Tuesday afternoon, Most of the flats around them were silent, and the street below was lifeless. The neighboring office blocks had no tenants, just a few furtive squatters. Where the sun penetrated the nearest building at just the right angle, Maria could see clothes hung out to dry on lines stretched between office partitions. Durham put on music, a 20th-century opera called Einstein on the Beach. He didn't own a sound system, but he called up the piece from a library he'd bought for the Garden of Eden, and had a background task play it through his terminal speakers. Maria asked, "What will you do with yourself when this is over?" Durham replied without hesitation, "Finish the whole set of 50 experiments, start Planet Lambert unfolding, celebrate for about a week, stroll down the main street of Permutation City, wait for your little locking device to disengage, wake up my passengers in their own private worlds, and hope that some of them are willing to talk to me now and then. Start catching up on Dostoevsky in the original." "Yeah, very funny. I said you, not him." "I'd like to think of us as inseparable." "Seriously?" He shrugged. "What will you do?" Maria put her empty plate down and stretched. "Oh, sleep in until noon for a week? Lie in bed wondering exactly how I'm going to break the news to my mother that she can now afford to be scanned, without making it sound like I'm telling her what to do?" Perish the thought.
Maria said simply, "She's dying, and she can save herself without hurting anyone, without stealing food from the mouths of the next generation, or whatever it is she thinks makes being scanned such a crime. Do you really think she honestly doesn't want to stay alive? Or wouldn't want to if she could think it through clearly, without all the guilt and moralizing bullshit her generation saddled her with?"
Durham wasn't taking sides. "I don't know her. I can't answer that."
"She was a child of the 90s. Her kindergarten teachers probably told her that the pinnacle of her existence would be fertilizing a rainforest when she died."
Maria thought it over.
"And the beauty of it is, she can still do that. Scan her. Put her through a meat grinder. Scatter the results over the daintree."
"You're a sick woman."
"I'll have the money soon. I can afford to joke."
Their terminals chimed simultaneously. The first 14 seconds of life inside were ready to be viewed. Maria felt the food she'd just swallowed harden into a lump like a closed fist in her gut. Durham told the program to proceed. The copies sat in a simple, stylized control room, surrounded by floating interface windows. One window showed a representation of a small part of the TVC lattice. The copy couldn't take the same god's-eye view of the lattice as they had. The software they'd used could only function on a level right outside his universe. There was no simple way he could discover the state of any given automaton cell. Instead, a system of construction and sensor wires, all joined to specialized processors, had been built around a small region in the center of the lattice. Durham had christened this apparatus the Chamber. What went on deep inside the chamber could be deduced indirectly from the data which ended up flowing down the sensor wires. It wasn't as complicated as working out what had happened in a particular accelerator collision, based on the information registered by surrounding detectors, but the principle was the same, and so was the purpose. The copy had to conduct experiments to test his own fundamental laws of physics, the TVC automaton's rules, and the simulated modern computers running his VR environment had a simulated link to the chamber, like the real-world computers linked to any real-world accelerator. The copy said, "Setting up the first experiment." He deftly typed a series of code letters on his keyboard. Durham had rehearsed the whole thing before a scan, until he could perform each of 50 experiments in 10 seconds flat. But Maria was still astonished that the copy, who had woken abruptly to find himself seated in the control room without any preliminaries, any chance to grow accustomed to his identity and his fate, had had the presence of mind to leap straight into the task. She'd entertained visions of this first version of Durham to wake inside a computer, finally realizing that the other 23 times were nothing at all like the real experience, and telling his original about it in no uncertain terms. But there didn't seem to be much chance of that. The copy just sat there typing as if his life depended on it. The experimental setups could have been automated. The checking of the results could have been automated too. The copy could have spent 2 minutes sitting and watching a flashing green sign which said, "Everything is just what you would have expected. Don't worry about the messy details." There was no such thing as a set of perceptions for the copy which could prove that he inhabited a cellular automaton which obeyed all the rules which he hoped were being obeyed. It was all down to Occam's razor in the end, and hoping that the simplest explanation for perceiving a display showing the correct results was that the correct results were actually occurring. Maria stared into the screen, over the copy's shoulder, at the interface window within. When he typed the last code letter, the assembly of cells he'd constructed in the chamber became unstable and started creating new cells in the surrounding vacuum, sending off a cascade which eventually impinged on the sensor wires. Disconcertingly, the copy watched both the simulation, on his own terms, of what ought to be happening in the chamber, and then a moment later, a reconstruction of the actual events, based on the sensor data. Both evidently matched the results of the simulations which the original Durham had committed to memory. The copy clapped his hands together loudly in obvious jubilation, bellowed something incoherent, then said, "Setting up the sec..." Maria was becoming giddy with all the levels of reality they were transecting, but she was determined to appear as blasé as ever. She said, "What did you do, wake him up with a brain full of amphetamines?" Durham replied in the same spirit, "No, he's high on life. If you've only got 2 minutes of it, you might as well enjoy it." They waited, passing the time checking software more or less at random, displaying everything from firing patterns in the copy's model brain to statistics on the performance of the TVC computers. Intuitively, the elaborate hierarchy of simulations within simulations seemed vulnerable, unstable, every level multiplying the potential for disaster. But if the setup resembled a house of cards, it was a simulated house of cards, perfectly balanced in a universe free of vibrations and breezes. Maria was satisfied that the architecture at every level was flawless, so long as the level beneath held up. It would take a glitch in the real-world hardware to bring the whole thing tumbling down. That was rare, though not impossible. They viewed the second installment of the copy at work, then took a coffee break. Einstein on the Beach was still playing, repetitive and hypnotic. Maria couldn't relax. She was too wired on caffeine and nervous energy. She was relieved that everything was running smoothly. No software problems, no Operation Butterfly, no sign of either version of Durham going weird on her. At the same time, there was something deeply unsettling about the prospect of the whole thing unwinding, exactly as predicted, for the next 6 hours, and then simply coming to an end. She'd have the money for Francesca then, and that justified everything. But the absolute futility of what they were doing still kept striking her anew, in between bouts of worrying over such absurdities as whether or not she could have made a better job of A. hydrophila's response to dehydration. Durham would let her publish all the Autoverse work, so that hadn't been a complete waste of time, and she could keep on refining it for as long as she liked before unleashing it on the skeptics. But she could already imagine the bizarre regret she'd feel because the improvements had come too late to be incorporated into the genuine Planet Lambert, the one they were currently flushing down a multi-million-dollar drain. She said, "It's a pity none of your passengers' originals have bodies. Having paid for all this, they should be here watching." Durham agreed. Some of them may be here in spirit. I've granted them all the same viewing access to the simulation that we have, and their auditors will receive a verified log of everything, proof that they got what they paid for. But you're right. This isn't much of a celebration. You should be clinking glasses and sharing caviar with the others. She laughed, offended.
Others? I'm not one of your victims. I'm just the confidence artist's accomplice, remember? And I'm not here to celebrate. I'm only here to make sure your doppelganger doesn't hotwire the software and wake me up.
Durham was amused. Why would he try to wake you up so soon? Do you think he's going to become unbearably lonely in the space of 2 minutes?
I have no idea what he might do or why. That's the whole problem. He's just as fucked up as you are.
Durham said nothing. Maria wished she could take back the words. What was the point of needling him and mocking him again and again? Did she think she could ever bring him down to earth? It was all a matter of pride. She couldn't let a second go by without reminding him that she hadn't been seduced by his ideas. Computer junkie, artificial life freak, she still had her feet planted firmly in the real world. His vision of an autoverse biosphere had impressed her, when she thought he'd understood that it could never be anything but a thought experiment. And all the work he'd done on the TVC universe was ingenious, however ultimately pointless it was. In a way, she even admired his stubborn refusal to give in to common sense and accept his delusions for what they were. She just couldn't bear the thought that he harbored the faintest hope that he'd persuaded her to take the dust hypothesis seriously. At 10:03, the money ran out, all but enough to pay for the final tidying up. The TVC automaton was shut down between clock ticks. The processors and memory, which had been allocated to the massive simulation, were freed for other users. The memory, as always, wiped to uniform zeros first for the sake of security. The whole elaborate structure was dissolved in a matter of nanoseconds. Night had turned the windows of the flat to mirrors. No light shone in the empty office towers. If there'd been cooking fires from the squatters, they'd been extinguished long ago. Maria felt disconnected, adrift in time. The trip north across the harbor bridge and sunlight seemed like a distant memory, a dream. The individual components of the Garden of Eden were still held in mass storage. Maria deleted her scan file, carefully checking the audit records to be sure that the data hadn't been read more often than it should have been. The numbers checked out. That was no guarantee, but it was reassuring. Durham deleted everything else. The recordings of the spy software remained, and they viewed the last brief scene of the copy at work, and then replayed the whole 2-minute recording. Maria watched with a growing sense of shame. The individual fragments had barely affected her, but viewed without interruption, the copy took on the air of a deranged sect leader driving a bus full of frozen billionaires straight towards the edge of a cliff, accelerating euphorically in the sure and certain knowledge that the thing would fly, carrying them all off into a land beyond the sunset. She clung to her rationalizations. The copy's limited separate identity, his joyful demise. When the replay stopped in mid-experiment, Durham closed his eyes and let his head hang forward. He wept silently. Maria looked away. He said, "I'm sorry. I'm embarrassing you." She turned back to him. He was smiling and sniffling. She wanted to embrace him. The urge was half-sisterly, half-sexual. He was pale and unshaven, obviously drained, but there was more life in his eyes than ever, as if the fulfillment of his obsession had liberated him from his past so completely that he faced the world now like a newborn child. He said, "Champagne?" Maria hardened her heart. She still had no reason to trust him. She said, "Let me check my bank balance first. I might not have anything to celebrate. Durham giggled, as if the very idea that he might have cheated her was preposterous. She ignored him and used the terminal. The $600,000 he'd promised had been deposited. She stared at the digits on the screen for a while, numb with the strange truth that the simple pattern of data they represented, sanctified as wealth, could travel out into the living, breathing, decaying world and return, enriched, beyond measure, imprinted with everything which made Francesca human. She said,
"One glass. I'm cycling."
They emptied the bottle. Durham paced around the flat, growing increasingly hyperactive.
23 copies. 23 lives. Imagine how my successor must be feeling right now. He has the proof. He knows he was right. All I have is the knowledge that I gave him that chance, and even that's too much to bear.
He wept again, stopped abruptly. He turned and gazed at Maria imploringly.
I did it all to myself, but it was still madness, still torture. Do you think I knew, when I started out, how much pain and confusion there'd be? Do you think I knew what it would do to me? I should have listened to Elizabeth, but there is no Elizabeth here. I'm not alive. Do you think I'm alive? If a copy's not human, what am I? 23 times removed?
Maria tried to let it wash over her. She couldn't feel simple compassion. She was too tainted, too culpable, so she tried to feel nothing at all. Durham had systematically pursued his beliefs as far as they could take him. He'd either be cured by that, or ready for another round of nanosurgery. Nothing she could do now would make any difference. She started to tell herself that by helping with the project, without ever conceding its premise, she might have helped him exercise his delusions. But that wasn't the point. She'd done it all for the money, for Francesca, and for herself, to spare herself the pain of Francesca dying. How dare the woman think of refusing? Copies like funerals were for the benefit of the survivors. Durham suddenly went quiet. He sat down beside her, disheveled and contrite. She wasn't sure if he'd become sober or just moved on to a new phase. It was 2:30. The opera had finished playing hours ago. The flat was silent. He said,
"I've been ranting. I'm sorry."
The two swivel chairs they'd been sitting on all day were the only furniture in the room besides the table. There was no sofa she could sleep on, and the floor looked cold and hard. Maria thought about heading home. She could catch a train and collect her cycle later. She stood, then, barely thinking about it, leaned down and kissed him on the forehead. She said,
"Goodbye."
Before she could straighten up, he put a hand on her cheek. His fingers were cool. She hesitated, then kissed him on the mouth, then almost recoiled, angry with herself.
"I feel guilty. I feel sorry for him. I only want to make up for that somehow."
Then he met her eyes. He wasn't drunk anymore. She believed he understood everything she was feeling, the whole knot of confusion and shame, and all he wanted to do was smooth it away. They kissed again. She was sure. They undressed each other on the way to the bedroom. He said,
"Tell me what you want. Tell me what you like. I haven't done this for a long time."
"How long?"
"Several lives ago."
He was skilled with his tongue and persistent. She almost came, but before it could happen, everything broke down into isolated sensations, pleasant but meaningless, faintly absurd. She closed her eyes and willed it, but it was like trying to cry for no reason. When she pushed him gently away, he didn't complain or apologize or ask stupid questions. She appreciated that. They rested, and she explored his body. He was probably the oldest man she'd ever seen naked, certainly the oldest she'd ever touched. 50. He was loose rather than flabby,
muscle had wasted, rather than turned to fat. It was almost impossible to imagine Aiden, 24 years old, and hard as a statue, ever succumbing to the same process. But he would, and her own body had already begun. She slithered around and took his penis in her mouth, trying to psych herself past the comic strangeness of the act, trying to grow drunk on the stench of it, working with her tongue and teeth until he begged her to stop. They rearranged their bodies clumsily, so they were side by side. He entered her and came at once. He cried out, bellowing in obvious pain, not histrionic delight. He gritted his teeth and turned ashen as he withdrew. She held his shoulders until he could explain. "My left testicle went into spasm. It just happens sometimes. It feels like it's being crushed in a vice." He laughed and blinked away the tears. She kissed him and ran a finger around his groin.
"That's awful. Does it still hurt?"
"Yes. Don't stop." Afterwards, she found she didn't want to touch him. His skin turned clammy as their sweat dried, and when he seemed to fall asleep, she disentangled herself from his embrace and shifted to the edge of the bed. She didn't know what she'd done. Complicated everything. Set herself up for yet another stage in their convoluted relationship. Or simply marked the end of it, bidden him farewell. An hour of disastrous sex hadn't resolved anything. She still felt guilty for taking the money, taking advantage of him. What would she do if he wanted to see her again? She couldn't face the prospect of spending the next 6 months listening to him fantasize about the grand future which lay ahead for his homemade universe. She'd taken some pride in the fact that she'd never once humored him, never pretended for a moment to have accepted his theories, and she'd never met a nominally sane person who could disagree with her so graciously. But there'd be something dishonest about trying to forge a lasting friendship between them, in the face of her skepticism. And if she ever succeeded in disillusioning him, she'd probably feel guilty about that as well. The long day was catching up with her. It was too hard to think it through. Decisions would have to wait until morning. Light from the kitchen spilled through the doorway onto her face. She called out softly to the house controller, to no effect, so she got up and switched off the light manually. She heard Durham stir as she felt her way back into the room. She paused in the doorway, suddenly reluctant to approach him. He said, "I don't know what you think, but I didn't plan this." She laughed. What did he think he'd done? Seduced her?
"Neither did I. All I ever wanted from you was your money."
He was silent for a moment, but she could see his eyes and teeth flashing in the dark, and he seemed to be smiling. He said, "That's all right. All I wanted from you was your soul." Chapter 20. Can't you time trip? Resting between descents, Pierre looked up and finally realized what had been puzzling him. The clouds above the skyscraper were motionless, not merely stationary with respect to the ground, but frozen in every detail. The wispiest tendrils at the edges, presumably vulnerable to the slightest breeze, remained undisturbed for as long as he studied them. The shape of every cloud seemed flawlessly natural, but all the dynamism implicit in the wind-wrought forms, compelling at a glance, was pure illusion. Nothing in the sky was changing. For a moment, he was simply bemused by this whimsical detail. Then he remembered why he'd chosen it. Kate had vanished. She'd lied. She hadn't cloned herself at all. She'd moved to Carter City, leaving no other version behind. Leaving him, or half of him, alone. The revelation didn't bother him. On the skyscraper, nothing ever did. He clung to the wall, recuperating happily, and marveled at what he'd done to heal the pain.
Back in cloud time, before, he'd always been descending. He'd set up the environment as usual, the city, the sky, the building, but frozen the clouds, as much to simplify things as to serve as a convenient reminder. Then he'd mapped out a series of cues for memory and mood changes over 15 subjective minutes. He'd merely sketch the progression, like a naive musician humming a melody to a transcriber. The software he'd used had computed the actual sequence of brain states. Moment would follow moment naturally. His model of a brain would not be forced to do anything, but would simply follow its internal logic. By fine-tuning that logic in advance and loading the right memories, the desired sequence of mental events would unfold, from A to B to C to A. Peer looked over his shoulder at the ground, which never grew closer, and smiled. He'd dreamt of doing this before, but he'd never had the courage. Losing Kate forever, while knowing that he was with her, must have finally persuaded him that he had nothing to gain by putting it off any longer. The scheme wouldn't slip his mind completely. He could vaguely remember experiencing exactly the same revelation several times before. But his short-term memory had been selectively impaired to limit the clarity of this recursive false history. And once he was distracted, a series of free associations would eventually lead him back to exactly the state of mind he'd been in at the cycle's beginning. His body, with respect to every visible cue in the environment, would also be back where it had started. The ground and sky were static, and every story of the building was identical, so his perceptions would be the same, and every muscle and joint in his body would have recovered perfectly as always. Peer laughed at his cloud self's ingenuity and started to descend again. It was an elegant situation, and he was glad he'd finally had a cloud reason to make it happen. There was one detail, though, which he couldn't focus on, one choice he'd made back in cloud time, which he seemed to have decided to obscure from himself completely. Had he programmed his exo-self to let him run through the cycle a predetermined number of times? ABC, 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 and then some great booming DEF breaking through the sky like the fist of God, or a tendril of cumulus actually moving, putting an end to his perpetual motion. A grappling hook could tear him from the side of the building, or some subtle change in the environment could nudge his thoughts out of their perfectly circular orbit. Either way, experiencing one uninterrupted cycle would be the same as experiencing 1,000, so if there was an alarm clock ticking away at all, his next cycle, subjectively, would be the one when the buzzer went off. And if there was no clock, he might have left his fate in external hands. A chance communication from another copy, or some event in the world itself, could be the trigger which would release him. Or he might have chosen absolute solipsism, grinding through the cycle, whatever else happened, until his executor embezzled his estate, terrorists nuked the supercomputers, civilization crumbled, the sun went out. Peer stopped and shook his head to flick sweat out of his eyes. The sense of déjà vu the action triggered was, presumably, purely synthetic. It told him nothing about the number of times he'd actually repeated the gesture. It suddenly struck him as unlikely that he'd done anything as inelegant as running the cycle more than once. His subjective time closed up in a loop, rolled in on itself. There was no need to follow the last moment with an external repetition of the first. Whatever happened externally, afterwards, the loop was subjectively seamless and complete. He could have shut himself down completely, after computing a single cycle, and it would have made no difference. The breeze picked up, cooling his skin. Peer had never felt so tranquil, so physically at ease, so mentally at peace. Losing Kate must have been traumatic, but he'd put that behind him. Once and forever. He continued his descent. Chapter 21. Remit Not Paucity, June 2051. Maria woke from a dream of giving birth. A midwife had urged her,
"Keep pushing, keep pushing."
She'd screamed through gritted teeth, but done as she was told. The child had turned out to be nothing but a blood-stained statue, carved with smooth, dark wood. Her head was throbbing. The room was in darkness. She'd taken off her wristwatch, but she doubted that she'd been asleep for long. If she had, the bed would have seemed unfamiliar. She would have needed time to remember where she was and why. Instead, the night's events had come back to her instantly. It was long after midnight, but it wasn't a new day yet. She sensed Durham's absence before reaching across the bed to confirm it. Then she lay still for a while and listened. All she heard was distant coughing coming from another flat. No lights were on. She would have seen the spill. The smell hit her as she stepped out of the bedroom. Shit and vomit, with a sickly sweet edge. She had visions of Durham reacting badly to a day of stress and a night of champagne, and she almost turned around and went back to the bedroom to open the window and bury her face in a pillow. The bathroom door was half closed, but there were no sound effects suggesting that he was still in there. Not a moan. Her eyes began to water. She couldn't quite believe that she'd slept through all the noise. She called out,
"Paul! Are you all right?"
There was no reply. If he was lying unconscious in a pool of vomit, alcohol had nothing to do with it. He had to be seriously ill. Food poisoning? She pushed open the door and turned on the light. He was in the shower recess. She backed out of the room quickly, but details kept registering long after she'd retreated. Coils of intestine, blood-red shit. He looked like he'd been kneeling and then sprawled sideways. At first she was certain that she'd seen the knife red against the white tiles, but then she wondered if in fact she'd seen nothing but the Rorschach blot of a random bloodstain. Maria's legs started to give way. She made it to one of the chairs. She sat there lightheaded, fighting to remain conscious. She'd never fainted in her life, but for a time, it was all she could do to keep herself from blacking out. The first thing she felt clearly was a sense of astonishment at her own stupidity, as if she'd just marched with her eyes wide open straight into a brick wall. Durham had believed that his copy had achieved immortality and proved the dust hypothesis. The whole purpose of his own life had been fulfilled by the project's completion. What had she expected him to do after that? Carry on selling insurance? It was Durham she'd heard screaming through gritted teeth, shaping her dreams. And it was Durham who'd kept pushing, Durham who looked like he'd tried to give birth. She called for an ambulance.
"He's cut his abdomen open with a knife. The wound is very deep. I didn't look closely, but I think he's dead."
She found that she could speak calmly to the emergency services switchboard puppet. If she'd had to say the same things to a human being, she knew she would have fallen apart. When she hung up, her teeth started chattering, and she kept emitting brief sounds of distress, which didn't seem to belong to her. She wanted to get dressed before the ambulance and police arrived, but she didn't have the strength to move, and the thought of even caring if she was discovered naked began to seem petty beyond belief. Then something broke through her paralysis, and she rose to her feet and staggered around the room, picking up the clothes they'd scattered on the floor just hours before. She found herself fully dressed, slumped in a corner of the living room, reciting a litany of excuses in her head. She'd never humored him. She'd argued against his insane beliefs at every opportunity. How could she have saved him? By walking out on the project? That would have changed nothing. By trying to get him committed, his doctors had already pronounced him cured. The worst thing she'd done was stand by and let him shut down his own copy. And there was still a chance. She sprang to her feet, rushed over to the nearest terminal, and logged back onto the project's JSN account.